From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll tell you about the mission of MKE's Outdoor-Indoor Exchange. We'll learn why cicadas captured the attention of people all over the country in 2024.
I really love them because they're cute and they're derpy and they've gone through a lot of hardship to get to where they are, but ultimately when they come out, they're beautiful and they come out strong and they come out in groups, and I think that's really neat of them.
Plus, we'll talk with some people who celebrate birthdays and anniversaries just every 4 years.
If you don't make these adjustments, then what you call the beginning of the year is going to fall in different seasons, which for most people around the world was not acceptable.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Reduce, reuse, repair. Those three words are central to the mission of the MKE Outdoor-Indoor Exchange Shop in Bayview. It specializes in making outdoor gear more affordable and accessible, while prioritizing sustainability. They buy, sell, rent, and repair everything, from hiking and biking equipment to camping and travel gear. It was founded by John Cameron, who was inspired by other gear exchanges he's seen out of state. Cameron sees his shop as a way to make a circular economy in Milwaukee and beyond. To learn more, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski visited Cameron at the shop.
When were you becoming more aware of the secondhand market, and you know, what made you want to be a part of it yourself as a business owner?
I've always kind of tried to live off the bottom of the world. Like, I don't think that I need to consume much, and I think that I've lived pretty large as far as living off the bottom goes. So I've always kind of tried to live without consuming, and I see that that's growing culturally, so I'm trying to just kind of contribute to it. But I've been a reseller most of my adult life, probably just from, you know, not having much money from whatever job you're doing at the time.
Do you think the view and perspective of buying secondhand, you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with thrift stores and that model, right? Mm-hmm. But what you have here is a little something different. Do you think in today's shopping market and changes of perspective that people are becoming more open and willing to participate?
I would say so. I'd say that there's still always going to be a cringe factor to used for whatever reason, you know, for whatever culture or people there are. But, you know, statistically, like, I think that there's a huge margin of people that are happy to, like, not consume, not pollute by using new products, and are tapped into the truth of it and, you know, and where their clothes really come from. So I think there's a lot of truths that people don't know that are the people that are also cringing at it.
Yeah, well, there's this concept and a term called embodied energy. Can you explain this and how it shapes your business?
Yeah, so everything I think about in life, I feel like kind of comes back to embodied energy. I think that, like, you know, it took this shirt, 2 boats, 4 factories, like 600 gallons of water, a bunch of pollution and dye out the backside of the factory. It took a cotton field to make it. It took, you know, synthetic fibers to weave it together. All those things and places and the origin of them add up to the embodied energy of the shirt that I'm wearing right now. So if we can alleviate all those processes by just using new or secondhand or repurposing things, those numbers are huge. They're giant.
So pivoting from an inspector in the corporate world to outdoor gear shop, what's your connection to the outdoors? Why did you want to focus on this for your first business venture?
So that's kind of funny, especially framed with the corporate interest first. When I was 15, I met some punk rockers that were riding trains, and I just wanted to be like them, so I did it. And I went to Key West on a one-way ticket, and I've slept in 48 out of the 50 states at least one or more nights. Doing that. So whether it was by thumb, by boot, or by rail, that's kind of how I got around our country.
So your experience hitchhiking around the country with, I'm sure, whatever gear you could find, to now helping people with some proper gear, yeah?
I have definitely tested some gear, a lot of different gear, all the different cook stoves. I've had so many different sleeping pads. I've had failures. I've had things that just lasted way too long that I'm ultimately impressed with, you know, yeah. So I don't share that all the time because it's not a focus of like outdoor hiking kind of health culture, but that is my experience. I slept on the ground a whole ton, a whole bunch.
So your model for this store, you buy, sell, consign, rent, and repair outdoor gear. So I want to break this down a little bit for any listeners who are unfamiliar, specifically about consignment. So I see some price tags around us, and they have certain dates with different pricing. So can you explain how consignment works?
Yeah, so with our system here, we do a 120-day period, and every 30 days, the item drops 10, 25, 50%. And then at the end of that period, it expires. So, you know, that gives it a good run at a few different price points. The focus is always used, but you're going to find a lot of new tags that are used. So we reach out to brands directly. I'm not going to list them because we're on the radio right now, but directly with brands. And the brands have been really reaching back to my business model and appreciating what I do. And my thing right now on a whole like kind of vision is I'm cleaning up the gear industry. I'm cleaning up the perimeter of the gear industry. There's a lot of overflow. There's a lot of excess. There's a lot of overproduction. And I'm just reaching out and grabbing that overproduction, that stuff that's new with tags, that beautiful, crispy garment, and then bringing it to you at a reduced price. Then we can take it down to even the local vintage hunter that goes out and they go to the thrift store and they dig through everything and then they bring me in garments. And then there's people who just simply are cleaning out their house or are serious athletes and have closets full of stuff. It's endless, the resources.
So remind me when you first opened this business.
August 1st, 2022.
All right. So being in it a little bit, can you talk about your mindset when you first dove in with both feet, you know, changing careers, starting a business? Entrepreneurship is a scary and challenging thing. What was going through your head?
I am a cancer survivor and I could not do my old job. I could not physically do my old job. And then I also was no longer able to have my old job because I had cancer for too long, you know, termination through corporate, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I was crazy. I was absolutely crazy to do this, to start a retail store, and especially a cringy used consignment shop, you know, in a state that's never even had a gear exchange. So they don't even know what I'm doing. It's definitely a little fringe. And I just think that I had faith in people wanting to recycle. And I just think that I had faith it would work. And, you know, I'm still sitting on faith. I'm definitely not sitting on a mountain of cash. So like, I'm looking forward to, I feel the traction right now. I feel the growth. There's a lot of room to grow and there's a lot more products out there that I can continue to get.
You mentioned you are a cancer survivor, and if you're okay with talking a little more about it, absolutely fine if not. But going through that experience, and I'm sure all of the challenges and the scary moments of going through treatment and coming out the other side, you know, not that it essentially makes you more of a risk taker, but does it help you view things differently in taking chances on yourself and your shop?
I would have never done this. I would have never had the option to take this risk. This isn't going to get me rich in the first year, and I'm already 40 years old, you know. I spent my 401k on this, and that was brave in its own self. It was the only money I had, and it was like the only option. I couldn't work. I still, you know, I still haven't eaten this morning because I can't eat half a stomach. It's just what it is. So I just kind of power through this stuff and get in what I can. And so this job's pretty much mandatory for me for a little while at least.
What kind of fulfillment does it give you, to have this space and to see your work come to fruition, but being your own boss, being able to work with what's best for you and your life and your needs?
It's really good. It's, you know, I really hope that my daughter and son get to see me be my own boss as they grow. But I've never been good at having a boss, and corporate, I was the square peg for sure. And so the best thing about working here though is like, you get to come in here with your like goals and your like wants and needs, the thing you save all your money to go do. You're like, I'm going to the Grand Canyon tomorrow, or I'm going to Belize, or I'm going to Guam, or wherever you're going. You've worked really hard to get there. And I get to like basically listen to how excited you are, help you with a couple things that are going to help you along the way, high five you, and then send you on that trip. And that is freaking cool because I get to see the best part of people. You're here to buy something special for the like one of the most memorable parts of your life. And that's fulfilling.
On that note, sometimes outdoor stores and the general culture of outdoorsiness, right, can feel exclusive or intimidating for some people who aren't familiar or diving in.
Absolutely.
And, you know, also just not financially intimidating or accessible, but culturally as well. And it can be a little unwelcoming to outsiders, or people might feel reticent to walk into a space they're not normally in. So how are you working to make this space welcoming and accessible?
The only people I make uncomfortable are the elitists. I try to make sure you know if you're a glamper, a camper, an RVer, a hiker, a hobo, I don't care. You're welcome here because, you know, there's only two places. There's outdoors and indoors. And if anyone wants to go and stake claim on it, you know, you can take their white flag and throw it in the river. That is not acceptable. You know, I think a large thing in society is people making up fake barriers to entry. And there are no barriers to entry besides the front door of your house on the outdoor world. So, like, now let me step back. If you're going to go climbing and you don't know how to climb and you fall and you hurt someone, yo, that's kind of your fault. And there's a lot of things that do deserve a barrier to entry. So let me not be too light on that when it comes to the safety and well-being of our clients and our people out there in the wild doing wild stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, like, if you're not wearing a Patagonia jacket and someone wants to give you guff for not wearing a Patagonia or not wearing a Canadian Goose, that person is a problem. You are definitely not the problem. You're welcome to be here. And, you know, if they were in here acting like that, I would make sure that they feel that same kind of whatever they're doing to people. It's not comfortable. And, you know, it's not theirs to take away from you. So
I also noticed that you often promote other people, other companies, and bringing them in and collaborating. I first met you at the indoor-outdoor gala that you held. So is this part of your personal philosophy or role that you see for yourself as a business owner in the community?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I grew up on punk rock music, and I think one of the words that really stick out over time is unity. And that's a culture that, like, you know, don't die easy is unify people. And so the gala is a good example of, like, what my philosophy is. I invited everyone here for free, even my competitors. The whole point is to provide a better outdoor experience for the people. And so if we gather ourselves together as retailers and guides and everything, and we know each other by first name and we know each other by their family and our friends and our products, then we're going to be a lot better at referring each other and sharing. You know, like, my friend just started a business called Forward Outdoor, and I'm really looking forward to watching him blow up because he has got the right mindset. And so supporting people like that, it's a pleasure and it's absolutely free. And, you know, we do a lot of clothing drives and stuff like that. And we only talk about half of the stuff we're donating because we're not trying to milk it at all. But, like, it's strange to me when people don't give back because it's so easy. I'm running this thing on a shoestring budget. I got two kids. I don't sleep. And I still can throw you guys a block party for absolutely nothing.
John Cameron is the owner of the MKE Outdoor Indoor Exchange in Bayview. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski at the shop last summer. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about the Milwaukee Public Museum's geology collection. But first, cicadas were a big deal in 2024. We'll tell you why, coming up on Lake Effect. On 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This summer was the summer of cicadas. After spending the last 17 years underground, millions of periodical cicadas emerged in southern Wisconsin. WUWM's Lena Tran and Jimmy Gutierrez went to Lake Geneva to experience the emergence for themselves.
So, Jimmy, we're past Labor Day weekend. Summer is coming to an end. How are we feeling?
All right. First, I live for a long weekend.
For sure.
Okay. But not to be too somber about summer, but it felt like a goodbye. And things I love are that kids are back to school. I'm not constantly sweating from all that corn. But I am already feeling nostalgic thinking back on summer.
And of course, thinking back on my summer, it was all about cicadas.
Oh my God. I feel like this was your best summer ever.
Best summer ever.
It was like equal parts the summer of cicadas and the summer of Lena, but because of the cicadas.
I was obsessed right away. I mean, they're underground for 17 years, feeding on sap from tree roots. They emerge and they just have a couple months to, you know, eat, be eaten, mate, lay some eggs. It's real circle of life stuff. And it kind of made me think about how at the beginning of every summer, I feel this need to have a really great one, to make something of these beautiful long days we have in Milwaukee, to not miss a single farmer's market.
Okay, can I say the farmer's market bouquets were out of control this year? But yeah, yes, agreed. Also though, besides farmer's markets and cicadas, this was a big summer for you.
Yeah, I'm going through this transition. You know, I just moved to Chicago. So this summer, I had to say goodbye to Milwaukee. I found these periodical cicadas to be weirdly relatable. And when I learned that Lake Geneva, right in the middle of Milwaukee and Chicago, is the place to experience Wisconsin's own brood, well, you know I had to drive down there.
That's the worst kind of ASMR for me.
It was insane. I could hear them through my car.
I don't like any of this.
Even with the windows up, the moment I crossed into town, it was like Lake Geneva. This place had been chosen.
All right, you just created a brand new nightmare for me.
Yeah, well, I talked to PJ Leash. He's an entomologist at UW-Madison. He says what we're hearing here is this duet between male and female cicadas.
A duet.
The males have these membranes on the side of their body called timbals. It's like the membrane on a drum. For this month or so while they were out, it's the males singing or screaming to attract the attention of females. At a close range, the females can snap her wings. And so you get this little back and forth calling between males and females. Eventually they mate. The females will then lay eggs. And a few weeks later, they're done and gone for 17 more years.
This wasn't going to happen for another 17 years. I was like, I need the people in my life to experience this.
I'm in your life. And you know, I'm always down for an adventure. So you, me, and our partners all carpool down. And I'm thinking maybe that in real life, the sound of them would be like soothing or maybe impressive. You know, after all, this is a summer of emergence.
It is. So next, we go to Lake Geneva.
Okay, maybe a bit of foreshadowing, but driving down, the sky was really gray. And it started to sprinkle, and the closer we got, the harder it rained.
It turns out cicadas aren't really fans of rain. You know, they'll crawl under leaves and take shelter, and that means no more mating calls.
I do think that we still made the best of it, thanks in large part to Cicada Palooza.
Cicada Palooza!
Yeah, Cicada Palooza, which is a real thing and was happening at the library. Downtown Lake Geneva was packed, all these puddled streets and cicada lovers and tour groups dotting each block. It was like Lena's as far as the eye could see.
These were my people. So many parents braved the weather to bring their kids. I met Annalise, she's 11, and her mom, Samantha, they came down from Argyle. Annalise could not drag her eyes away from this little jar that had two cicadas she'd caught. And Samantha told me that the two of them are bug nerds.
That means when you see something, you're like, oh, come look at this!
Like when I saw the cicada emerging earlier.
Yeah.
I'm like, come, everyone.
look. It's like you just won the jackpot. Annalise, these cicadas are older than you. Like, and they're just about ready to vote. I mean, they're getting to be to the point where, yeah, like anybody that's like here, yeah, it's a good chunk of your life is like, they've been down there underneath our feet, not even knowing that they were there.
All right, this image is not helping. I did find someone who did help though. And there were these really cute entomology students from UW. And they had a good reframe for me other than zombie bugs. Ari Maurer even got philosophical talking about the cicada journey.
So cicadas are a creature of patience, right? They spend all of this time underground and they're just waiting for this perfect opportune time. What's crazy about them is we don't exactly know why they know it's that opportune time, and we don't know why they come up every 13 or 17 years, they just do it. And I think that's something a lot of people relate to. They spend their entire lives waiting for that kind of perfect time. But unlike cicadas, we have to realize that we don't just have a vibe like that or a feeling. We got to take that own initiative. And I think that they make the gigantic jump from underground to on trees, and we can do the exact same thing. I really love them because they're cute and they're derpy, and they've gone through a lot of hardship to get to where they are. But ultimately, when they come out, they're beautiful, and they come out strong, and they come out in groups. And I think that's really neat of them.
All right. At this point, like, I'm all in. I'm full on Team Cicada. And then under this tent of cicada plushes, yes, cicada plushes, I look to my right, and there's a small child, and he's got cicadas crawling all over him.
Oh, my God.
What is that on your hand?
A cicada.
Cicada? Are you not scared that it's, like, crawling all over you?
No.
What does it look like?
It looks like a big, huge, fuzzy, like a baby frog.
Like a baby frog?
But more than their legs, and it has wings, and red eyes.
It looks like it's very curious of you, too.
Yeah, it likes me.
All right, this is Soren Binney, and we talked for a bit. He calmed me down, and then he had a few questions for me.
Do you like cicadas?
Do I like cicadas? I am learning to like cicadas, and you made me braver to feel like I could hold a cicada, so if you can believe it, I'm actually going to go and try to eat a cicada.
Oh my gosh.
All right, I just want to be clear here that this did not come out of nowhere. This was always kind of a part of our unspoken mission, especially after so many people at Cicada Palooza talked about eating them and that cicadas were on every menu in town.
Jimmy, somehow you went from being kind of squeamish around just the idea of cicadas to being very committed to eating one. And I mean, you know, I was down to eat one.
I mean, if I saw Soren handling them, it felt like a call to action, a call that I had to answer.
I really wanted this to happen for you. And because of the rain, we saw the cicadas we could. I was hoping there would be enough to swim in, but, you know, maybe I can settle for enough to eat and drink.
And so it began. I looked up every place that served food and drink. I'm talking breweries, fancy seafood spots, ice cream parlors. Anyone and everyone that was open, I called and asked, hey, by chance, do you have cicadas on the menu? And I will say, I have not felt as rejected since I was a teenager. And then an angel answered the phone and said, yes, we can put cicadas on anything. Maggie Moo's Dairy Ripple was my savior, and salvation was a mere 15 minutes away.
We should say that you didn't just call these places. We went to a number of them, a supper club, this bar. We even followed a lead from someone who said they were selling seasoned cicadas by the pound in the parking lot at a state park.
It sounded so promising.
Yeah, but the ranger gently informed us this was not the case when we pulled up to the gate.
Not that sells them to eat, not here.
This is why Maggie Moo's hurt so bad.
We've been had.
All right. Well, you guys are cute. This place is cute as hell, so maybe we'll just get something to eat that's non-cicada related.
If I give you a bowl of dipped chocolate, you can pour it on whatever you want to. I'm not saying you have to pour it on cicadas, but you can. But I'm not going to allow any cicadas into my building.
Okay, fair. Understood.
All right, so it's a little bit of a gray area.
Okay.
I don't like bugs.
The same.
But if you have some cicadas of your own, that's your choice.
Okay.
I will give you whatever you need to dress them with.
So, quick update is that called up Maggie Moose. They told me we can put cicadas on anything. Very promising. And we get here, and they have cicadas on nothing. They said they will not let them into the shop. And it turns out they thought that I was calling and pranking them. And in turn, they pranked us.
I felt very bad that our cicada adventure was such a bust. By this point, we'd pretty much gone full circle around Lake Geneva, so we were back in town.
But you did have a genius idea.
The cemetery?
Yes, the cemetery, because we had all the dip set to go. We just needed some cicada protein.
Yeah, I didn't know if you were serious, but if you were, I knew the cemetery was the stop. It's the oldest one in town, so it was one of the best places to see tons of cicadas. They haven't been disturbed for almost 200 years.
You were right. There were tons of them.
Oh, hell no.
It's making noises.
Can you hear?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like hissing almost.
I don't know if I can eat him.
I don't know if I can eat him either.
They're so sweet. I'd like all
Jimmy,
my
how are we feeling here?
Like a coward. Like I was ready to be a coward. Like besides all the cicadas, the cemetery was pretty empty. There was, though, a couple across the street that we noticed. The trunk of their car was open, and they were kind of huddling over it and looked like they were working on something.
Are you all performing cicada science over here?
We are.
Wait, what's happening over here? Do you mind? We're with Milwaukee Public Radio, so.
Oh, right on.
We are collecting whatever we can from Chicago and from here and from Wisconsin to see what we actually collect, if we can tell the difference between the different species. Okay. So we're preserving them in some dry ice, labeling where we got them from. And I'm going to take them back and look at them under a microscope, see if we can differentiate the species, see if we can tell which broods are which, if they're the 17 or the 13 year.
Okay. Yeah. Okay,
all right, that's Erica Morales. She's an entomologist at New Mexico State University. And she had recruited her partner, Chad, possibly against his will, to be her assistant.
When we first arrived here, we went to go get some pizza in Chicago, and we are walking around in the parking lot, and they are everywhere. It was perfect. I was kind of in heaven, and the first thing that one does to my finger, as I picked one up, they say they don't bite, they say they don't sting, which they technically don't bite or sting, but they may tell you they pierce. And one little guy landed on my finger, and he's like trying to put her little proboscis or her mouth part. She's trying to put her mouth part into my finger, and you can see her trying to get some phloem from there, but she's not going to get
much. She thought you were a tree.
She thought I was a tree. Best compliment ever. Best compliment ever. Yeah.
I have a question about food. Have either of you eaten them yet, or have any interest to eat them?
Just did at the library.
Yeah, I spoon fed him. I spoon fed him a cicada. He had no idea what was going in his mouth. They were handing out these little ice cream sundaes. I was actually going to eat it, and I don't know if you said something or if you looked at me. I'm like, oh, he wants one. So I just picked it up, and I spoon-fed it to him. I was like, oh, by the way, I think this is the
cicada.
Yeah,
we still have a little bit of growth in our relationship. And oh, he wants one. No, that's not what I was saying. That's not what I was communicating.
Cicada.
But it wasn't. So the next question, it was a little crunchy. Yeah. It was just like any other little crunchy topping you might have in your ice cream.
Okay.
No other particular flavor.
Not freaked out, no hesitation.
Of course I was freaked out. I was like, what the hell? But no gross taste, no, just an emotional reaction. Like, oh, that's a
that's where we're at.
Chunky. That's where our relationship is at.
We might not have heard the collective scream of cicadas that day. We might not have eaten them, but we did find this really sweet cicada science couple. So I just want to check in with you. Where are you now on your cicada journey?
Yeah, still have not eaten, but I still have my butterscotch dip. But I felt like the cicada and I grew closer, you know? Like, it felt like at the end of this, it was a summer of emergence. The cicada people emerged, you included. I did as well, handling bugs. And I did lean into the wonder of how wild an occurrence this really is. And, you know, at the end of the day, what is summer if it's not love, big transitions, and a little buggy?
Yeah, I love that. The cool thing about these periodical cicadas is they kind of let us time travel. Like, I can picture it 17 years from now, getting excited for another emergence. But also, I'll be thinking back to this summer and how I fell under the cicada's spell, and how we had this ridiculous adventure in Lake Geneva. I'm really grateful for the cicadas. They made my last summer in Wisconsin, for now, one to remember.
All right, so Lake Geneva reunion, 17 years.
See you there.
That was WUWM's Lena Tran and Jimmy Gutierrez reporting on the cicadas last year. The Milwaukee Public Museum has more than 4 million artifacts in its collections. Many of those items either haven't been displayed or have only been viewable during certain exhibitions. If you head to the geology department in the basement of the current museum space, you'll find many artifacts that have never been seen on the museum floor. There are a lot of reasons for that, as Patricia Kura-Burke explains. She's the curator of the geology collection, and she led WUWM's Eddie Morales and myself through the vast room that holds fossils, minerals, and rocks for our series Behind the Scenes at MPM. We explored some of the collections from the Milwaukee Formation, a geological formation in Milwaukee County that contains fossils from the time when the land, now known as Wisconsin, was located deep below the water near the equator.
Okay, so we are entering the geology storage area of the Milwaukee Public Museum. This area houses most of our early Paleozoic rocks, all of the minerals, and some of our vertebrate collection. And it is pretty much full to the ceiling. So just to give you a sense of what's going on here.
It is crazy just how much is in this space.
So one of my projects for the past 10 years has been to move our handwritten collection records from those old catalog books that you might see in, you know, weird places like libraries, or we're moving that information into our collection management system. And I've had grants from the Institute of Museum and Library Services to do that. So I've gone from the Silurian, was my first grant, and as that grant started, we started to realize that we might be moving to a new facility. So as part of that project, I added on a little, to make it easier to move, we tried to give every specimen a digitally readable label. So everything should have, most things have a QR code, and every drawer has a QR code. So when it's time to move, they should be able to scan the drawer, know what's in it. Let's knock on wood that actually happens. You know, there's a lot of things here. So things would be easy to get lost. So that was our project. So we went from the Silurian, which is about 420 million years old. That's when the ancient reefs were really dominant around Milwaukee along the coast. Then we went to the Ordovician, which is a little older, and did that. And now we are working on the stuff very close to Milwaukee, the Devonian. And that is the Milwaukee Formation, which you guys have probably heard about. And some of the cool things that you can find in the Devonian are fish. We have fish material that people don't think of that far back as having fish. And they certainly don't think of Milwaukee as being a place where you're going to find fish fossils. A lot of this material was salvaged when they were digging the new intake tunnel. The city of Milwaukee was digging a new intake tunnel, and that went under Lake Michigan, out pretty far out into Lake Michigan. As they tunneled, the material got pulled back and piled just to the north of UWM, I think is where the piles were. And so there was this very ambitious young man who was growing up on the west side, Gilbert Rosch, and he would take the trolley every weekend when he was in high school, went over to those piles, went through and collected a lot of this material. And so it's actually a legacy of Gilbert Rosch that we have this material. He went on to UW-Madison to get a PhD in geology, but he was very close to the curators here, and his collection ended here.
What year did most of this come into the collection?
I would say the 1930s, because he actually got a stipend for giving this to MPM, and he used that to pay to go to college. So it's actually sort of a cool story, this kid growing up on the west side, taking the trolley to collect all this stuff, and he knew all of this stuff.
You mentioned a little bit about like the efforts to digitize it and to organize it. Can you talk about, is that different across different departments? Some of what's going on here with the QR codes, or is that kind of standard across different departments?
Well, there's a standardization, but like each department has their own data that needs to be put in. Like, for instance, in geology, we have a collection event, but we also have to know what layer of rock this material was collected from. Remember I said geologists give every layer of rock a name? So if we look at this, you can see that the rock layer was the Milwaukee Formation. And then we even dice it a little more, and we call it the Bertholet member. So there, we split that one layer into parts. So other departments don't need that information. So each department has their own information that needs to go into the data management system. But we're all using catalog numbers as our essential record.
Now, looking at these, I'm seeing kind of a red outline.
That was drawn on so you could follow what you're seeing. And so this would have been a part and a counterpart of this fish.
Okay.
So let me see if I can get it to go back. I don't like to play with it too much because it scrapes up the, yeah, I can't quite get it.
But
when he found this rock, probably tapped it, split it open, and it split into these two halves, and you can see, and there's even, you know, you can see them, it's sort of the thin material right there.
It's amazing what's in these, because I'm like, as we're looking at this, I can see kind of the outline of the fossil, and as you mentioned, like a piece of fin, but then I'm also seeing what to me looks like a crystal almost.
And that's what it is. That is what it is. So this would have been a void where groundwater percolates through and fills in these spaces. So this is calcite, and the other mineral that's frequently found in the Milwaukee Formation is millerite, which is this very, a lot of times it's this just like thread thin needle of mineral.
We're looking at this one drawer. We are in a room full of these drawers. Why do items like this end up down here in a drawer versus up in the museum on display?
Well, I mean, take a look at it. If you just walked up to this display, would you know that this was a fin, this was some special fish? So there's only so many things you can display and relate any information about those things. The other part is that some of these things are down here in this drawer, but they're used by scientists. So some of this material was used just a few years ago in a paper that just looking at the fish from the Devonian. So that's one aspect of it. The other, which is sort of important now, is that as we've advanced in our ability to analyze things, people can take something that has a little bit of a fish fin and they can analyze, you know, what is making that up down to the molecular level. So there's a lot more we can learn from these now with our testing and our imaging techniques than we could have in 1930, or we could have even in 1990. Some of this is preserved for scientists to do things that we don't even know we can do yet. Those things are, you know, waiting for us to figure out.
Patricia Kura-Burke is the curator of the geology collection at the Milwaukee Public Museum. She spoke with me and WUWM reporter Eddie Morales for our series Behind the Scenes at MPM. At WUWM.com, you can find more of those conversations about the museum's many collections. A new season of Bubbler Talk is underway, but we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. 2024 was a leap year. We'll hear stories from people who have a special connection to February 29th, next on Lake Effect. On 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. 2024 was a leap year, meaning there was a February 29th on the calendar. It happens only every 4 years and brings about some extra special occasions, like people who were born on February 29th, known as leaplings.
Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with some people who have a significant connection to Leap Day, and she brings us this report.
My name is Anna Flock Arcello, and I was born on Leap Day in 1984.
My name is Aaron Arcello, and I was also born on Leap Day in 1984, and I'm married to Anna Flock Arcello.
Aaron and I met when we were living in New York City, and I went to his apartment with some friends for a party, and someone randomly introduced Aaron as a person who had a leap year birthday, and I was really taken aback because it's kind of rare to have somebody you meet have a leap year birthday. And he was really cute, and so the combination of those two things together kind of took me aback. And then he played it really cool and did not seem that interested in it.
I did play it very cool. I think my response was something along the lines of, oh, cool, you're also born on leap year. So was my roommate's mom, and so was that guy over there.
Yeah, it was too cool. For me, I grew up in a small town, and so I grew up kind of never knowing anyone who had my exact same birthday. And so the fact that Aaron was born in Rhode Island, I was born in Michigan, and here we were meeting in New York City just felt like this completely cosmic sort of thing to me. And it just felt really exciting.
I think it became such a core part of our relationship story. And it was something that I stopped playing cool and started embracing. I loved, you know, the cosmic kind of romantic quality about it. And the idea of being born on the same day in the same year and finding each other means that, you know, we've spent every day on this earth at the same time, you know, not necessarily together in the same place, but we've been on the same kind of cosmic journey in life together since February 29th, 1984. And I think that's really special and an amazing relationship story that we have.
Yeah, it's definitely a core part of kind of how we introduce ourselves. Obviously, it's a really key icebreaker. So when you say, you know, oh, I'm born on February 29th, and then you kind of pause and you're like, and so is my husband. I mean, people are usually really intrigued by that and find it really unique and different. I do remember after meeting Aaron, we didn't start dating right away, but I remember calling my mom and being like, I met this guy and he's really cool and he has the same birthday. And she was just like, you have to go for him. It has to happen.
On the outside of Anna's engagement ring and then on the inside of my wedding band, my best friend is an artist and he designed this interlocking 22984 design. So we have that as part of our, and it forms a heart and it's kind of interlocked.
Yeah, and now we have kids and I think they are real strong evangelists for February 29th. They're really interested in it and they tell all their friends about it. They're really excited, so it's kind of cute. And every time we have a leap year birthday, we definitely go big. And so we'll either take a trip or we'll bring friends together or we will have a big party. And so I think that's usually how we've celebrated most of our leap year birthdays over the course of our life. We tried a long time ago to figure out what are the chances of two people being born on leap day. I'm not a good enough mathematician to figure that out, but it is the rarest birthday, so.
It is. She's one in a million for sure.
Thanks.
My name is Christina Land, and I was born on Leap Day back in 1980. My special Leap Day birthday traditions are I really like to play into the number in terms of how many Leap Days have I had. So this year, I will be turning 11 for the second time. And an excuse to do something silly and youthful for my friends, we're going to go up to Thurston Bowl and play that crazy game they've got going on up there. We've got some Connect Four basketball going on. And so my main tradition is just getting to do something youthful that normally my friends and I don't do on the weekends. Growing up, my mom was also really into what was the number and what age am I turning. So when I turned 12, also turning 3, I had a dance party in our dining room, as you do as a 12-year-old, and my mom had a giant banner made, so it said like happy 3rd birthday / 12th birthday, so she always sort of played into that, so that was always a fun thing growing up, was that my mom acknowledged every 4 years that this was even more special than the other 3 out of 4 years. On a non-leap year, I mean, we all want a birthday month. And I figure if you don't have a birthday, then you do just get the whole month, right? Like, I'm going to own February for every non-leap year. One of the pros of having a birthday every 4 years or having a birthday as unique as Leap Day is it's a built-in conversation starter. I work in corporate America, so we often have to do icebreakers. I'm meeting new customers. I'm meeting new employees all the time. And having a fun fact about yourself on hand is always really helpful as you're starting to do those introductions. So I always have a built-in icebreaker, so that's definitely a pro. I've got a couple of stories about cons of a Leap Day birthday. One, which is very small, is not every website acknowledges that February 29th exists. So when you're putting in your birthday for whatever reason into a website, I've emotionally accepted. Sometimes I have to say my birthday is February 28th because they don't know and they don't have it in the list. And the other one, it's not legally recognized until March 1st. So being the good UW-Milwaukee college student that I was, when I turned 21, I went to BBC, which is now Hacienda, up on North and Farwell. And when the gentleman at the door carded me, he noticed that the under 21 line was different than my birthday, because I was under 21 until March 1st, 2001, and my birthday is February 29th, 1980. So I had to stand on that corner explaining to him how the calendar works and that my birthday was real, my ID was real, and it wasn't a fake just because those dates don't match up. So that was a little bit of a con, but it only happened once or twice. I think the only cool perks were for being a Leap Day birthday I've come across is just an excuse to act immature and blame it on my age.
My name is Drew Shackelford, and I'm connected to Leap Day because that is when I asked my husband, Scott Casey, to marry me.
My name is Scott Casey, and my connection to Leap Day is that it's the day that my wife, Drew Shackelford, asked me to marry her.
I chose Leap Day to ask Scott to marry me specifically because I thought it really fit the kind of whimsical tone of our relationship, but also it's a really old tradition in the British Isles that on Leap Day, women get to ask men to marry them. And I thought it was absolutely perfect. So a few months before, kind of set about researching it, seeing about all the old traditions, and I decided to just surprise him one frosty morning. It was really, really cold outside. I remember that. And I don't know, I thought it was kind of perfect.
It was quite a surprise. When Drew asked me, like she said, it was a frosty morning and we'd had a German breakfast of pretzels and sausages. I lived in Germany for a long time. And then she said, let's go for a drive. And I was a bit confused because it was so cold. And we went out to a special spot for us, a very special spot now, under a tree in a park. And it was pretty desolate. There was no people there and I was kind of confused about why I was there. But then she just pulled out a bottle of champagne and I looked at her and said, are you going to ask me to marry you? And she did.
I would say that I had been planning on asking him to marry me 5, maybe 6 months. The thing is, sometimes he would just look at me when we were having a beautiful moment and he would say, will you marry me someday? And he would say that over and over again. And so I knew that eventually that was going to be what we were doing. And I just decided to go ahead and claim my date of February the 29th.
We didn't get married on the 29th. And we do have the separate wedding anniversary. But I like this one better. Because, you know, it's not one you kind of have to, you know, for a wedding anniversary, you know, it happens every year, so it's a little bit more routine. But when it's something like this, you know, it's a day that doesn't exist in another year. And so you can kind of go all out. And so I've got some things planned, which I can't really go into, but they don't involve us being in the state of Wisconsin, I can tell you that much.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. He keeps giving me little hints here and there about it, but not anything substantial. So I think it's absolutely brilliant because, like Scott said, having an anniversary once every 4 years means that it doesn't happen the other 3 years. It just doesn't exist the other 3 years. So we can acknowledge that leap year, then it happens, and we get to enjoy that magic very sporadically. And October 9th, our wedding day anniversary, so we get to celebrate our anniversary no matter what. But we get to go all out on February 29th and really put a lot of emphasis on our own personal holiday, I guess, for us.
Anna Flock Arcello, Aaron Arcello, and Christina Land were all born on Leap Day. We also heard from Drew Shackelford and Scott Casey, who celebrate their anniversary on Leap Day. That story was produced by Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll wrap up our favorite conversations from 2024, including a conversation with an award-winning taxidermist who's responsible for preserving the beloved gorilla Samson at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Plus, we'll tell you about the return of an organ to the Oriental Theater. Thank you so much for joining us right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.